Hello, and welcome to The Deep Field. I'm your host, Cole Chakey, and I'm coming to you from inside a photo booth. You remember photo booths, right? I'm actually in one of the few remaining chemical photo booths in operation in Canada. This one happened to be in the food court in North Hill Mall in Calgary. Now, I was inspired to take this little trip after chatting with Makes Fitzgerald, who has sat many times in this very booth and hundreds of other photo booths across the globe. And now her photo boothing, her many-year love affair with photo booths, has been beautifully captured in a new graphic novel called Photo Booth, a Biography. This graphic novel memoir came out this fall, but I actually met Megs a few years ago. Together we starred in a sort of experimental romantic comedy short film shot during Toronto's Nuit Blanche Festival. And in this short, Megs plays a photo booth artist, and on film, her and I flipped through a binder full of photo booth strips from her teenage years, photos that she and her friends really took while growing up in Edmonton. So thanks to Megs for chatting with me, and thank you all for joining us. Now, my conversation with Megs Fitzgerald.
Hi, Megs.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so good.
Great.
We've been chatting, but I haven't actually told you how in love with this book I am.
Oh, thank you.
I just love it. Congratulations.
It wants to marry you. So,
well,
yeah, it loves you back.
That's very...
Yeah.
It's so sweet.
Yeah. You're already married, I know, but...
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what the legal rules are with polygamy
it's different
and inanimate objects.
Yeah.
This book's fascinating, and you're a fascinating person. And so why don't we just maybe start with your first encounters with photo booths and how you discovered them, how they discovered you.
Yeah. Well, I think like any teenager, I wanted to see pictures of myself. Even if I didn't think I was particularly attractive or anything, I wanted to sort of see my world reflected back at me. And I graduated high school in 2005. So this was just sort of the start of when digital cameras became accessible. And like, I had never even seen a scanner at that point. Like that was a mythical thing to me. So by taking photo booth pictures in these analog chemical photo booths, that was the only way that I could get these instant pictures of me and have my world reflected back at me. So it was just a hobby with friends, and we would take pictures and trade them. And after doing that for a while, we'd think, well, why not bring in our own backgrounds, and why not wear costumes, and why not try to time it this way and spell out messages? And so it just became a creative outlet.
Mm-hmm. And so your friends were into it at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was the leader. I was the most adamant that we take pictures, but I had a whole bunch of friends that were very happy to appease me and had their own collections going too. And we would, you know, tape the pictures to our binders and that sort of thing and show them to each other. We didn't have iPhones, right? So this is the way that we took our selfies and shared them.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And then when did it start to become like a medium, like an artistic medium for yourself?
I tried to introduce them into my quote-unquote serious artwork when I was a student at ACAD, but the work was not received very well by my teachers or my peers, and I don't blame them for that. I had really amazing peers and faculty there, but I think I was really struggling with the transition between hobby and fine art, and these machines seemed very low and what I was doing was supposed to be very high, and so the work I was producing was really subpar. And part of that is that with a photo booth, you can't control the photo that's going to come out in a lot of ways. You don't know what the lighting is like in that machine and how hot the chemicals are at the time, and all of that's going to affect the quality of the photo that you get.
Yeah.
Much later on, you know, years after that, I was lucky enough to have access to photo booths within photo booth warehouses where I could take unlimited pictures and get the settings just quite right, so I wasn't, you know, saving my loonies and toonies. And with that, I also had access to the inside of the photo booth, so I could use different filters and gels, and I could adjust the temperature and the exposure and all sorts of things. So, yeah, my photo booth art now is still entirely analog, but I just have a bit more control behind the scenes.
So when you were at ACAD, there was no resident photo booth on campus, right? So you were still taking these...
Yeah, I was actually using the photo booth in North Hill Mall most often. And there used to be one, it's still there in North Hill Mall, the chemical one. And then there was also one in Eau Claire Market that's now been replaced by digital.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's a whole world we'll get into as well. But what can you describe some of these, what you call non-successful?
Well, I did experiment a lot with what I called like post-production. So instead of trying to take instead of trying to alter the photo within the photo booth with backgrounds and costumes and extra lighting, post-production was the idea of altering it after the fact. Mm-hmm. So what could I do to the strip once it came out and kind of taking away a bit of the sacredness of its original state? So I would embroider into it or burn it or cut it up and collage it. And I think by doing that, I was really trying to force it to be something it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Now the photo booth art that I make, that I've exhibited in some places, it's all about the fact that it was made in a photo booth, and this is what you're able to do using this really particular medium.
Right. And it was part of the reaction from the faculty or other students is that you weren't following in a high art tradition or even a low art tradition, but kind of like there was no documented tradition of photo booth art at the time?
Yeah, there was photo booth art. I wasn't aware of it. Mm-hmm. The first international exhibition of photo booth art was in New York City in 1987. And that exhibition was just called Photomaton. And I had no understanding of or no knowledge of that when I was a student. I learned about that later, and it really opened my eyes to be like, wow, this is what people are doing with it. And I had always made images either just within the single photograph or within a strip, but I realized that many people were actually compiling all these strips and then making a larger picture, sort of using this grid system of the photo booth strip side by side. Mm-hmm. But we're calculating... To create this bigger image had to take these photos in such a specific and difficult way where they're measuring the time and what composition had to be in each frame to make the bigger image up.
Yeah.
So, very intensive.
Yeah. So when you were at ACAD and it wasn't getting a great response, what made you not abandon photo booths?
I kept doing it, but I just did it in private. Yeah. You know, like it was like, okay, I can go back to being a hobby. And I remember I was a student, I think in my second year, when I took my 1,000th photo, and you know, it cost $4 for a strip of four photos in color chemical photo booths these days. And so that meant a lot to me. It was like, I've spent $1,000 on photo booth pictures. And I wasn't, you know, ashamed or aghast by that. Instead, it was like really a proudful thing. And I've always said that I take photo booth pictures instead of smoking cigarettes. You know, like that's where my money goes.
Yeah.
So I was pretty good as a student. I would use a booth about once a week. And so that time is pretty well chronicled, but they were just sort of, you know, stayed private that way.
And because you've held on to all of them, right?
Yeah.
Or almost all of them?
Yeah. There's actually... Of the almost 8,000 photos that I have right now, there's only one that I don't have, and that's because a guy who had a crush on me stole it from my collection. I found out much later. That's the only one I'm missing. Yeah, that was from like 2004, probably. Yeah, I am thankful that even as a angsty teenager, I was really fastidious and really anal about my collections. So I at first I had kept my collection just in my wallet, mm-hmm. and then I made sort of a purse to hold them, and I had a secret slot within the purse where I could put like nude topless photos I'd taken of myself so my friends wouldn't see it, but it was still with the collection. And then finally it just got too big, so I graduated to binders and put the images in plastic sheets so that I could see the front and back. Mm-hmm. And on the back of every photo I had dated them and wrote the location and who I was with. So they're all in my binders chronologically, with the exception of the photo that was stolen from me. This, of course, was before scanners or before scanners were really accessible. So as a teenager, I was paranoid about losing my photos. So I went to Staples, which used to be just down the street from where I went to high school. And I color photocopied my images after I took them. And those were the images that I would like put on my binder or put on my locker or whatever.
Right.
Not the originals.
Yeah. Because, so I learned so much about photo booths.
Yeah.
Reading this, which is fascinating, including I didn't know that there's no negative to a photo booth. That the strip is the one and only original.
Yeah, it's the film and the paper.
Yeah.
I didn't know that when I started out either. It wasn't until... probably 2012 that I learned that. And when I found out, it blew my mind. And it really made me love the process even more to know that everything was original.
Do you think that getting infatuated with photo booths is an inherently kind of teenage thing? Like, did it caught you in your teenage years? I'm assuming you would have seen photo booths as a... 7-year-old,
yeah.
We all did. But what is it about this kind of teenage-ness that made it click?
Well, at least for me, they were these little places that while I was in public, I could escape to and have a little private shrine. So whether I was using the photo booth that day sort of as a theater while I was doing something performative, or whether I was using the photo booth that day as sort of a closet to hide in.
Yeah.
There are a lot of photos I took of myself when I was younger and still now that are really unflattering. You know, and mm-hmm. I would take them at the end of a bad day, and I wasn't taking the pictures to make me feel better, but it felt like, well, you know, I have good days and I have bad days. I might as well document the bad days too. So,
yeah.
Photo booths were there for me, and they were these little shrines that I could disappear into for a little while.
And that's what I found so fascinating about reading it is considering that it is this weird little bubble of public and privateness
mm-hmm.
at the same time. Because it is, yeah, it's in a mall or a train station or something, but you do get a couple square feet of privacy.
A private space, for sure. And I talk about a moment in the book, too, and I don't want to spoil it or anything, but I'm in a train station in Italy, and I'm feeling completely claustrophobic, and I have to escape to a photo booth. And it was digital, but I at least created some space around my body by being in the photo booth.
Yeah.
And so it sort of protected me in that moment.
And there's, like, the little curtain that comes across, right? And
Yeah. But it's apropos. It's only a half curtain. You know, like mm-hmm. your legs are still seen.
Yeah. And it's timed, right? Like you can't spend an hour in there. The photos are coming out. So you need to either have someone there or pop your head out.
Yeah.
At least
yeah.
like there, it's not a locked door.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's fascinating to me about the book is it's so many things. It's the sort of memoir of yourself. It's a bit of a technical manual, mm-hmm. an illustrated manual. And a history of photo booths, and also this amazing portrait of this kind of beautiful, quirky international community. So mm-hmm. How did you discover your people?
My people? Well, it started with a Google search. Mm-hmm. And I think I was looking up photo booth. I think at first I was looking for locations. I was trying to see if anyone put a database together of where the chemical photo booths were. And I did find some early lists that were really kind of patchy and outdated. And then by 2006, I found out that there was this website had just launched, and it's called photobooth.net. It still exists. And these two people, I didn't know them at the time, but now they're good friends of mine, Brian Meacham and Tim Garrett. They had joined forces to create this beautiful website that was not just chronicling where you could find photo booths, these chemical photo booths, but also any trace of photo booths in media and television. Mm. Anytime it comes up in a film, and the community sort of found this website, and it runs, these databases are compiled by people who send in submissions. So it was there that I really first found people, but I was... And it's so silly now that I was as shy as I was, but I was too shy to contact them directly and to really be involved. So there wasn't really anyone in Canada who was documenting all of the photo booths across Canada for the website, but I knew we had so many more than elsewhere in the world. So I waited for a really long time, and I was like, I'll compile this master list of all of the photo booths in Western Canada and like some in Quebec, and then I'll just send it all at once in just one, you know, like, here, I hope you enjoy this kind of message, right?
Yeah.
I thought that would be like a normal thing to do. So Brian responded just being like, what? Like, who are you that you just from nowhere just sent us, you know, like, I don't know what it was. I think like 25 or 30 photo booth locations out of the blue. So after that, I eased up a bit, and I would send them kind of one, two at a time. And still to this day, I do that. I actually have I have three locations I have to send into them of booths I visited this summer.
Yeah. And so obviously it seems from the book that they were excited to find...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everyone in the community that I have met is so excited to just find other people who have the same interest as them.
There's nothing more endearing than meeting someone with a shared passion, a niche passion that is not common to every person who walks down the street.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're talking about photo booths, but this applies to anyone who has, you know, a team of people who restore pinball machines, or who they play online poker with, or I don't know, that they know dog breeders online or whatever. And then when they finally get to meet each other in person, it really clicks and feels so awesome to be with your people.
Yeah. Well, so tell me about going to some of these photo booth conventions, because conventions mm-hmm. are sort of, I mean, like Comic Cons are the pinnacle of this, but any kind of specialized convention has that weird kind of magic where you realize that we're all together.
Yeah, yeah.
And we all have one thing in common.
Yeah. It is a bit of a misnomer to call them conventions. It's probably more accurate to say festival. Hmm. Because convention implies it's sort of a trade show or something, and really there's nothing for sale.
Right.
Photo booth companies will donate their paper and their chemicals and their time to setting up photo booths for use for free vend, so anyone from the public can come and take free photos. And then there's, you know, a series of workshops and panels, and so we might hear from people who are experts in collecting vintage photos, and we mm-hmm. might hear from technicians who have all these incredible stories from 30 years on the job. So the first time I was able to go to a convention was in 2012. I knew they've been happening before that, but I always had conflicts as a student, mm-hmm. and I'd always sort of beaten myself up for the fact that I couldn't go. So in 2012, I found out about the convention. It was posted in February, and it was happening in May. And I was living in Halifax, and I was totally broke. I was living off a student loan, and I just thought, like, I have to go. Like, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I have to go. And so this is when, you know, the crowdfunding was still relatively new, at least in Canada, because a lot of platforms didn't support it in Canada. But Indiegogo did, so I decided, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to put together an Indiegogo campaign to get myself there. And I thought, like, well, I can't just ask my friends to fund my vacation. Yeah. The convention that this particular year, it changes every year, but this year it was in Venice, California. And I was like, I can't just ask people to, like, fly me to LA, right? Yeah, like, that's just too extreme. So I was like, I'll make a 32-page comic, and by saying it's for my art, then people will support it. And of course, the 32-page comic became my 280-page graphic novel. So mm-hmm. after the convention, you know, one thing led to another. But at the convention, which really started it all for me, I just got to meet these people I'd only known online, and people whose work I really admired, and people who I just, you know, felt flustered and tongue-tied around. And it was incredible to form these relationships with them.
Yeah, and then that kind of launched you on a bit of an odyssey around...
Yeah. Odyssey is a good word. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't always easy or always fun. But I found a way to make it work, and I got a lot of support from people along the way. So aside from the Indiegogo campaign, I had strangers contacting me in other cities saying, like, oh, you can stay with me for free, or, hey, we met a few years ago, I'm a stewardess now, you can have one of my buddy passes. Yeah. and all sorts of support like that. That was really incredible.
Where have you been photo booth-wise?
Yeah.
This is a big question,
well, yeah.
I know, but...
So I did travel in a way that I was researching photo booths before the Odyssey, as you would call it. And that's because I used to do, and I guess I still do, improv theater. Mm-hmm. And so with improv, I toured and performed in a few different cities, a few different countries for about 18 months after I graduated from ACAD. So every time I went to a city with improv, I found all the photo booths in the area, and I took pictures in them and documented mm-hmm. them and submitted them to the database on photobooth.net. So I already had a good amount of information before going to Europe specifically to study photo booths and meet these people who are running these small businesses. So within Europe right now, a lot of companies are buying up the old chemical photo booths from Canada and restoring them, and then starting these indie businesses, because Europeans can tell the difference between chemical and digital.
Yeah.
And they want to use the chemical ones, and it's not being made by the major company there. So instead, these photo booths are getting put in trendy bars and art spaces and museums. And a lot of those machines are coming from Canada. So I wanted to go and meet these people who are part of this grassroots sort of revival movement and interview them and make some friends. And that's what I did.
Yeah. And so let's get into this question of digital versus chemical photo booths.
Yeah.
So first off, I guess if you could define the terms, if you could explain what we're talking about.
So with the chemical photo booth, it's a machine that essentially has a mini dark room in it. And instead of a person who would be taking a photo and putting it in and out of these trays, like in a dark room with different chemicals in the trays, it's all mechanics. And there's an arm in the middle of the machine called a spider. And the spider lifts the photo strip in and out a set of 14 tanks to develop the photograph. And then it's delivered to you. The digital photo booth, they could actually be made a lot smaller than they are, but often when they're placed in malls and train stations, they're made as big as they are so that people know what they are because they already recognize the footprint of the chemical booth. And so the digital photo booth is as simple as having a digital camera, a simple computer program that allows you to interact with it, and then a laser printer in there. And there's something to be said for the digital experience, but for me, it just doesn't quite feel the same. When you take a picture with a chemical photo booth, it's the only picture. And when you take it with a digital photo booth, that file is saved and reproduced. And then I can almost guarantee you it's going to be looked at later by someone at the photo booth company. And all of those images are put, you know, somewhere on a hard drive. Mm-hmm. So it's not private in that same way. And then, with the digital experience, you usually can take your photo multiple times until you're happy with it. And that just ruins the experience. I want the photo to be candid, and even if my eyes are closed or even if I wasn't quite ready for the photo, that's part of the moment. So.
Yeah, that's a kind of interesting part of digital photography in general, you know, like how easy, and I'm entirely guilty of it, when you're taking photos, you're like, oh, and you're just instantly deleting them. Like
there's a point
where there's no...
We self-edit all the time. And I think about that with just the digital era in general, that it would be so easy for all of our files to be wiped out. Mm-hmm. Not many people carry physical copies of photographs anymore. And if any sort of anthropologist from the future would want to look to our era and say, like, well, there's no record of these photographs. Oh, they're in magazines. Oh, this is what people looked like then?
Yeah.
But we don't look like people in magazines, right? Mm-hmm. We're not airbrushed and we're not all perfectly lit. So I think we're sort of leaving a weird trail for ourselves. And even if, you know, some catastrophe doesn't wipe out all of our digital files, like, who knows if a computer's going to read a JPEG in 50 years from now.
Even so, yeah.
You know, I have files saved on floppy disks that I don't have access to.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, I was married last year, and our wedding photographers were really adamant that we print all of our photos.
Because
they were saying, like, even just physically, a flash drive will deteriorate within a decade. That's a physical property of it. And they spoke really passionately about the value of printing. And then during the Calgary floods year and a half ago or so, they did this wonderful volunteer effort where they had people bring in their flood damaged photos and did like a kind of saline clean, because they're really resilient
in
the end. Like, physical photos are tougher than a lot tougher than the CD that I have.
Yeah, well, absolutely. With photo booth pictures in particular, there are photos that are almost 100 years old that are in the same condition as the day they were taken. And on the flip side of that, there are digital photographs that were taken a year ago that have, you know, sat somewhere near a window and they've been sun faded, and the only colors that you can really still make out are blue.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the digital photographs that are taken now are really not archival. So this may seem like it's not that big of a deal, but I'm always thinking about the past and the future and maybe not enough about the present. But with my collection, I really want one day to be able to give it to my grandkids and say, you know, here is my life documented in this one form. And you can see the good and bad in it.
Which is going to be an amazing gift. Nana was a photo bug. And for a project we did a year and a bit ago, I went through all of her photos from pre-war and during the war. She was a nurse in London. And they're so precious. They're like these artifacts, these photos as artifacts are some of the most precious things I have of my Nana. Much more than physical objects. And it's also seeing what your grandma looked like at 20 is amazing.
I bet she was hot.
She was...
Is she listening to this?
She was beautiful.
Yeah.
She was beautiful, but that's the thing. It's also a capture of style, and you're like, oh, this is what like this is what nurse uniforms look like. And then this is what they dressed up to go. Because she grew up in a tiny Alberta farm town. And then there was photos of her, like, out on the town in wartime London.
Yeah.
Which is really... And likewise with you having photos, especially, I mean, I was so thankful when she would write dates and names and stuff on the back. And so your photos from all over the world, it's an amazing little treasure box.
If I become really famous one day, it can go in a museum. I screw my grandkids. I don't mean
they can
that.
Visit. They can visit.
They can
grandma's
visit.
Photos.
They can put on white gloves and visit.
Hey folks, we'll get back to Meg's in a moment, but I just wanted to jump in and share with you what we have in store for a very special Christmas episode next month. Next up on The Deep Field, we'll talk to this young, baby-faced, 30-something-year-old actor who also happens to be the resident Santa Claus at Calgary's busiest mall. We just finished up having our interview, and the story behind the beard is so interesting, and I'm so excited to share it with you. We'll have brand new episodes of this podcast every month, and we don't want you to miss a one, so subscribe to us now on iTunes so you'll always be one of the first ones to hear us. You're listening to The Deep Field. Let's get back to my chat with Megs Fitzgerald.
There's another character in this graphic novel that's fascinating, and that's the inventor of photo booths, Anatole, am I saying?
Yep.
Anatole. Can you tell Anatole's story a little bit? Because this is, I mean, we talked about you going on an odyssey, but this is epic story.
The story is incredible, and I was really, really fortunate that I was able to find his granddaughter. So his name is Anatole Josepho. His original name was Anatole Josephowitz. He changed it when he moved to China, actually, to make it a little easier. And so his granddaughter, Sharon, was really wonderful in sharing information with me. So he had been written about before, but I feel like I got a really good insight into who he maybe, you know, who he was as a person and not just as a businessman. Mm-hmm. So he was born and raised in Tomsk, Siberia, and he was a Russian Jew. And life was not entirely easy for him. He was born at the end of the 18th century. Is that correct? No, 19th century. He was born at the end of the 1800s. Thank you. Yes. And he had an aptitude for technology and for tinkering and just figuring out how things worked. And he obviously had an incredible sense of adventure, because when he was a teenager, when he was 15, he set out to live in Berlin on his own. And his dad bought him a one-way ticket, and he just went. And so while he got there, he convinced a photo studio to train him and hire him on. And photography had just become accessible to the average person around this time. And the Brownie camera was invented and released on the market in 1900. So people were able to, it was still a difficult medium to work with, but average people could still work with it. So he lived in Berlin for a while, and then he went city to city collecting new experiences. He saved up enough eventually to go to the States and tried to make it there, but found that it was very difficult. So he came back to Europe. He moved to Hungary and found himself in the heart of the First World War. So it was a very tumultuous time to be a Russian in Hungary. And he ended up having to escape. But a lot of people were escaping, trying to come back to the States, but he didn't want to come back to the States. So instead he decided to travel back through Russia, which was an incredibly dangerous route to take. He almost died multiple times, and then he found himself in China. So all this time, I should say, he was working in portrait studios and sort of in secret working on his invention, which he had a great business sense, and he knew that if he could develop this idea for this photo booth, he didn't call it that. There were already some automatic portrait making machines, as they're often called, but the science really hadn't been perfected. They were very finicky and they needed a lot of servicing. So he found himself in China, started a photo studio there, and after being there for several years and establishing himself and raising money, he felt ready to come back to the States. So he landed on the West Coast, and there he studied the earliest motion picture cameras in Hollywood. He got his way up to New York City, where he met with a funder who actually made the papers that made cigarettes. And that individual was willing to invest in his photo booth idea. And that individual also was the father of Anatole's future wife, Ganna. And so Ganna and Anatole together opened the Photomaton Studio, and that was on Broadway, and it was a massive success. It blew people away. This was an invention that, like, changed the world overnight. It's hard to describe how exciting it would be to people. If we think about people now lining up to get the new iPhones,
yeah.
I guess everyone wants to know what new thing the iPhone could do. Imagine if the world knew that there was something like the iPhone, but no one could quite imagine it yet.
Yeah,
like the
yeah.
kind of lineups that would have, right?
Yeah.
So,
and it's not an abstract thing. Like, to have your photo taken and given to you for the first time in your life.
Yeah.
Like, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's entirely...
Yeah, absolutely.
Paradigm shifting, or
yeah.
whatever those fancy
yeah.
terms are.
So those are original photo strips were actually 8 shots. That machine that Anatole invented, that was in 1925 that it debuted. It was pretty clunky. It was made of wood. It needed to actually be connected to a plumbing source. So it wasn't entirely a freestanding machine. But within a few years after that coming out, there were huge improvements. And the Photomaton company went public in 1927, and Anatole became this sort of rags-to-riches poster boy as he sold his idea for $1 million, which was huge in 1927 money. Yeah, so he went on to live a wonderful life after that, and there are many, many stories about his generosity and his follow-up inventions. But Photobooth was that was always sort of his passion project.
Yeah, and it, you know, it just seems to me like that idea of sort of affordable access or kind of public access, equal access to this new technology is really revolutionary.
Absolutely. So as soon as the Photomaton company went public in 1927, they went to work setting up machines very thoroughly throughout the United States, and then not that long after throughout Europe and in Canada. And so what it did is it meant that almost anyone, if they had a quarter, could take photos of themselves. And a quarter in those days' dollars is about $4 now. It's always kind of stayed at the same cost. Most people can afford $4 for a photo if they really need it. And so that meant that populations that were lower income or that had otherwise been marginalized were for the first time able to take their own pictures. Mm-hmm. And that's really important because a lot of photo studios were ran by, you know, white straight men. And so if you were African American, and even if you could afford to have your photo taken in a studio, the relationship you have to the person taking the photo may not be ideal for you.
Mm-hmm.
So Photobooth really documented a lot of African-American communities in the States because they were able to control the photo-taking experience the way that they wanted it to be
done.
Yeah,
yeah. Because I guess a machine on itself can't be prejudiced.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah. And then same thing for couples, for gay couples. So they couldn't just waltz into a photo studio together and pose kissing in front of anyone. You know, it was considered a crime in many places. And so the privacy, just that little half curtain, pulling that across,
yeah.
you know, gave them enough of a safe space where they could, you know, kiss and smooch in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And not just kissing and smooching. I've seen some very illicit photos. Yeah. Everything you can think of. Cocaine and flashing guns and lots of body parts. Yeah. Thrilling for people, I'm sure.
Yeah. And so you were able to meet with Anatole's granddaughter.
Well, we never actually met. She was living in the States while I was finishing the research of my book. So we just had many long phone conversations. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
The people who love Photobooths are super, super passionate about it. But because there are so few people in the world who are passionate about Photobooths, us passionate folks don't get many outlets to share these ideas. So as soon as you put two of us in a room, you know, we can just explode with, you know, geeky technical talk mm-hmm. or, you know, with interesting history talk or just with, you know, talking about other people in the community. It's kind of like family reunions where you just want to catch up.
Yeah. My favorite person that you met in the book is the guy whose mom worked at the the manufacturer, and has been on photo booths for years and has kind of publicly aged on them. Tell me that story.
Yeah, so I, a few years ago, started noticing that within Canada, on the photo strips on the sides of the booths that are sort of the sample strips, that it was just the same people over and over again. And so I started taking pictures of these sample photo strips, and then I compiled my pictures and I looked and I was like, wow, like this one man appears many, many times. So I wrote a blog post about him. Sort of invented him as a character and kind of theorized why he was on all these photo booths across this nation. And I named him Desmond. And so I called the project Tracking Desmond. I actually gave everyone names so I could keep track of them. And then quite some time had passed, and then I was actually contacted by a journalist from the CBC who was interested in the story, and she and I did a radio piece together. And after that radio piece aired, I got this mysterious email, and it just said, my name is not Desmond, my name is Brian, or something along those lines. And it wasn't like a let's talk or let's be friends, it was just sort of correcting me on that, and I was like, what?
Yeah.
So I emailed him back, and sure enough, he lives outside of Montreal, and his mom, she still is, her name's Louise, she works for the auto photo company in Montreal, and they're the company that operates all the photo booths across Canada. And so Louise had brought her son in from the time that he was six up until 2005 to have his photo taken to make these sample strips. So the majority of his life is, of Brian's life, is chronicled on these machines. And it's wonderful to be able to go to a machine and say, oh, I hope I'll see, you know, Desmond/Brian today. And, you know, from what era is this from? And what's his hairstyle like? What kind of glasses does he have at this time?
Yeah. Amazing. So I wanted to ask you about this phrase you mentioned in your talk, and you'll have to remind me the term, but the people you said you've heard from some folks who have a true love for physical objects. What was that term?
A lot of people self-identify as objectum sexuals. The other word that's thrown around sometimes is objectophilia or objectophiliacs, but that sort of implies that there's something wrong with it or a disease or something to be treated. Mm-hmm. And that depends on your perspective, but most people who are objectum sexuals don't feel that there's anything wrong with them. And these are people who have transferred the emotion that we would typically feel for another human being onto an object. So sometimes it's onto a really particular object, like their favorite guitar or their keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
Instruments are sort of a common thing. Or it's to a public monument. So like the Eiffel Tower or the Berlin Wall before it fell. These are things that the people would fall in love with. Yeah, I've heard from all sorts of people since the book has come out, and a lot of people have related to it. And so one of the groups that I heard from were from a few objectum sexuals. And I don't want to say that's as if that's the only thing they're about, but people who self-identify that way. And they could relate to some of the content within my own book, because I, towards the end of the book, sort of identify the fact that I'm struggling with multiple failed relationships and having to give up relationships to study photo booths and to work with photo booths. And so photo booths really became the center focus of my life. You know, like a child, if you have a kid, that's all you can kind of think about. Well, that photo booth really occupied that for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I transferred a lot of intensity and feeling to them that I wouldn't maybe normally feel for a person.
Well, and because like any other relationship, it's not all honeymoon phase stuff with you and photo booths. You know, there's
photo booths and I fight.
Which is fascinating to document and to see a progress in, like it's a memoir and a story of a relationship.
Yeah. And I know someone could say that that's all in your head, and I think that there's some truth to that. But photo booths are really alive. You know, like you have this interaction with them, and it's like a give and take between posing and putting the money in and waiting. And there are finicky machines that are always going to be finicky and no technician can ever sort them out. And then there are machines that are just like beautiful and responsive, and you can tweak them and with beautiful results. And so I think, you know, I have a relationship in some way or another with every photo booth I've ever used. And I certainly have favorite machines that I feel, you know, like we just connect when I sit on that stool.
Quite literally, right? They're tactile.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like there's a physical contact with it.
And you're in them. So it's like getting hugged by a machine in my mind, you know? Like you're just going to be within this thing that you have these feelings for. It's a really, it's a safe, sacred space for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where do you see the future of photo booths going now, like in light of cell phone cameras and digital media? And
Well, we know within Canada that the last of the chemical machines that are sort of sprinkled across the country will be taken out by the end of the summer of 2015. Autophoto's been taking them out gradually, so people may have noticed, you know, there are none in Regina anymore, and I don't think there are any in Saskatoon either. There's only three left in Calgary, so the numbers have been dwindling for a while. Once those are gone in Canada, then it will really be up to individuals who may see a business opportunity to buy one from Autophoto and to learn how to service it themselves and then put it in a cool bar, right? Mm-hmm. The photo booths that are being taken out, about half of them are being replaced by digital machines by the same company, and the other half aren't being put back just because we all have cell phones with cameras.
Yeah.
We just don't have the same need to document ourselves and to take ID pictures with the help of a machine anymore.
Yeah, it's like the telephone booth in a way, right?
Exactly. It's hard to find a telephone booth these days. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And within the rest of the world, the sort of grassroots movement to bring photo booths back is well and strong. It's really taking off in a lot of areas. I have a lot of friends who run very successful small businesses operating these machines, and it's the thing that they do for their entire livelihood. Mm-hmm. But there's sort of a cap probably on that as well. So the paper for color photo booth pictures stopped being manufactured in 2007. So that stock is really quickly depleting.
And finite, yeah.
It's very finite, yeah. And with black and white paper, that paper is still being manufactured, but by only one manufacturer in the world, and that's in Russia. So if they chose to stop making it, photo booths would only really have kind of 5 to 10 years left in any sort of public way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when the chemical photo booths are taken out by this company, individuals could possibly, like, they don't necessarily go straight to the trash heap, like they could be.
Well, they would unless people, you know, contacted them ahead of time and said, like, "Oh, I kind of like a Model 17P if you've got one."
Yeah, yeah.
Which they will, but you don't really want a photo booth in your home because of the chemicals, and they guzzle a lot of power as well. So if you want to own your own photo booth, it'd be great if you had a garage or a studio or something like that.
Yeah. Is this a desire of yours to one day own one?
Yes, it is. I don't have anywhere to put it because I move all the time. So that's a trouble. That's part of the problem. I do technically own a booth that's in storage in Chicago that I refurbished myself. But it's kind of like saying, like, oh, I have a car, but your car is like this beater car that shouldn't be legally driven. And it's like from 1984. That's great. You have a car, but you don't own a Ferrari. So I own the beater of photo booths, and it's in storage because it's really expensive to ship it up to Canada. So one day I may use that and place that somewhere and service it. For now, I'll let it sit and continue to age. Would I love like one of the Cadillacs of these photo booths? Absolutely. And one day I hope to be ridiculously wealthy and have copious amounts of space to place these machines.
Like how Jay Leno has like an acre.
All these cars.
Car.
Yeah. And there are celebrities. They like to remain anonymous, but there are celebrities who are big fans of the photo booth community, and they own these vintage machines. Mm-hmm. Many of them operating like these rare, rare models that there are only six left of in the entire world.
Yeah.
So the community has a good company in it.
Do you have a favorite photo booth?
Well, my favorite model and favorite booth are the same. A Model 11 is my favorite type, and that was a booth that was designed in the early 50s by the Autophoto Company out of the States. And it is a really feminine-looking machine with curved sides and chrome siding and just beautiful typography on the sides and on the door on the inside. So it's a real luxury item. And my particular favorite of it is in Chicago in the studio that I worked with there. And theirs is actually in a Model 11A, which meant that it was designed for prisons. So with that machine, they would have taken mug shots originally. So it actually has fewer fancier bells and whistles because of that, but the photos are all the same.
Thank you once again to Megs Fitzgerald. If you like the wit and passion that Meg spoke with about photo booths, stands to reason you would love her book. You can find Photo Booth, a Biography, online or in bookstores. The Deep Field is produced by myself, Cole Chakey, and Anton DeGroot, and we are thrilled to welcome producer Laurel Green to our happy little podcast family. You can find us on iTunes, where you can also subscribe, rate, or review us, which helps you not miss an episode and helps us find new listeners. So if you like us, please take a moment and click that little review button on your iTunes page. Thanks for listening. Till soon. This photo booth totally just stole a toonie from me.
That was the sound of the photo strip dropping into the slot. Oh no, I'm too tall. Cut off my forehead.